Welcome to Snack Break. We speak to experts, mostly about policy, but also about snacks.
The proliferation of weapons of mass destruction is one of humanity's greatest threats. There's the ever-present danger of loose nukes and chemical and biological weapons falling into the hands of terrorists and nefarious actors. And there's the challenge posed by states like North Korea and Iran. Earlier this year, President Trump agreed to a summit meeting with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un to resolve tensions on the Korean Peninsula, though Trump has also expressed an eagerness to exit the 2015 Iran nuclear deal. His hardline stance toward Iran has recently been bolstered by the arrival of his new national security advisor, John Bolton, and new Secretary of State Mike Pompeo. What is the future of the global threat of weapons of mass destruction? And what can we expect from the Trump administration? This is Snack Break. I'm Aru Mukherjee, and joining me today is Ambassador Laura Holgate, who served as President Obama's representative to the Vienna Office of the United Nations and the International Atomic Energy Agency, also known as the UN's nuclear watchdog. She previously served as a senior director for weapons of mass destruction, terrorism, and threat reduction at the National Security Council. Laura, thank you so much for joining.
Great to be here.
All right, now you've been studying and working on weapons of mass destruction, issues of weapons of mass destruction, for decades now. What are they?
What are weapons of mass
destruction? Yeah, they sound big and scary. What do they actually look like?
Well, they are scary. They can look like a whole bunch of different things. Certainly, if you're thinking about biological weapons, it could be a syringe that has a virus that someone puts in their arm, becomes sick, and then gets on an airplane and spreads it to the passengers that they encounter on the way. For a chemical weapon, sometimes they're in large bombs that are dropped from airplanes, sometimes they're in artillery shells, and as we just found out in the UK with the Novichok, sometimes it's just a little fairy dust that's spread around. Nuclear, similarly. We've all seen the pictures of Fat Man and Little Boy, which are huge, but the US and the Soviet Union made nuclear weapons that you could carry in a backpack.
Nuclear issues are all over international headlines right now. How easy is it to get a nuclear weapon? Could I get it on the internet, on like the dark web, or how tough is it to get these things?
Well, it depends on how you're starting. From the notion that there is an actual full-up weapon that is going to somehow have exited the control of the state that made it and that it gets into some gray zone commerce is probably pretty unlikely. We were a little bit worried about that in the collapse of the Soviet Union and making sure that all of the warheads got back to Russia from Kazakhstan and Ukraine and Belarus. But having done that, having created U.S. support systems to do that, everyone's pretty confident that those weapons all made it back to where they were supposed to be.
So nothing was lost in that, and there must have been thousands or hundreds at least.
There were thousands.
Wow.
And it's a real tribute to the Russians for how serious they were about that, and they will tell you that they were grateful for the U.S. support that made it safer and faster to get that job done. So the thing that we really worry about under the heading of loose nukes is not necessarily the weapon itself, but the materials. Highly enriched uranium, plutonium, these are used in peaceful purposes for energy, for research. They're created in factories and used in reactors around the world.
And so who would sell something like that to a bad actor? Would it be a state?
Well, the cases that we have that we know about where there has been nuclear smuggling of material that was high quality enough to use as a bomb, it was pilfered originally by workers at the bomb factory or at the materials factory. So taking highly enriched uranium out of the production line in small pieces, taking it out of the factory, stockpiling it in one's own home, and then handing it off to a middleman. And then it's the middlemen that are, it's that handoff. And so that kind of leaves open the question was, who did the middlemen think they were going to sell it to?
Right.
But that's the model we know about. And in that case, it was almost certainly not with the knowledge of the state, but it was a reflection of the lack of serious security at the site, which is a state responsibility, that someone could, in fact, pilfer.
And then even when it gets to somebody, say that middle person sells it to a group or an individual, that person's still going to need like a missile or some sort of weapon, right? I mean,
Let's think about it. When we designed the Little Boy bomb that was used in Japan, The design of it was so self-evident that we didn't even test that design before we used it. And that that kind of a very simple, highly enriched uranium weapon, you know, maybe 50 pounds of highly enriched uranium, and you need someone who knows a little physics, someone who can do metallurgy, who can shape that uranium metal into the appropriate forms, someone who understands explosives and firing sets, which, you know, plenty of evidence that the terrorist community has that skill set down. And then it's just a matter of a truck, a fishing boat, a privately flown aircraft, you know, maybe even a drone.
So it's not that hard.
So
once you have the material, the difficult part is getting the material.
Precisely.
Is that correct?
Precisely. Okay. No nuclear material, no nuclear terrorism.
And you worked on all these issues. You were on the National Security Council under Susan Rice, who is National Security Advisor. And so when you were up there up close watching this, the coordination between the agencies, what was the feeling like? Did you feel that there was a real threat, or are people kind of freaking out about it a little too much? Is it exaggerated? Or are we not spending enough time on it?
Well, there's no need to freak out, and that'll lead you to solutions that are not very usable, not very worthwhile. This has been a concern, you know, frankly, going back to the 1970s, and that terrorists might get access to material that they could make into a fashion into a weapon. It became much more acute after the collapse of the Soviet Union and the concerns about the the lack of control over either weapons or materials that happened at that time. Then it was intensified after 9/11, when it became clear that terrorists were smart, well-resourced, excellent planning and logistics, and that you started to think about, well, maybe a terrorist group really did have the capacity to put all those pieces together that I was just mentioning and create a device that would create a nuclear yield. And so what had been a very former Soviet Union-focused effort to lock down material, eliminate material, consolidate it in a limited number of storage, improve the security around that storage, that became a global effort in the early 2000s after 9/11. And in that time, we've shrunk by half the number of countries that even have material that you could use to make a weapon, from 50 to 25. Many of those countries have nuclear weapons, so, or at least, well, 5, 7, 8, depending on how you want to count. So those are embedded in a military program, and countries are usually pretty careful once they make it into a warhead. They keep track of those pretty well. So to me, there's kind of two big threats from the materials point of view. One is neglect or overconfidence in a national security program, and I think we have that in Russia, where they actually don't haven't internalized the reality of the threat, and in a country with, you know, declining federal budgets, corruption,
so their security is not that good.
A culture of not telling the bosses bad news. Yeah, I worry very much about the durable security of Russian materials over decades. And then any other country that's kind of like not taking it seriously, complacency is the biggest threat. But from a intentional state point of view, that's where I really worry about North Korea.
Yeah.
And it's been a concern of mine for years now of when will North Korea decide they have enough highly enriched uranium or plutonium for whatever enough warheads are, and when they get to that tipping point that they may be so strapped for cash that they will be willing to sell, and to sell it to a state actor who's looking for a clandestine program, sell it to a non-state actor who's looking to create a weapon. That's my worry.
So, I mean, one of the issues here, of course, is that our sanctions are hurting the North Koreans, but also might make them, ironically, more willing to sell their nuclear material so that they can prop up their economy. Is that correct? So there's sort of a weird incentive schemes here operating
yeah.
simultaneously.
Well, the North Koreans are really good at hiding commerce. You know, there's a great story in the Washington Post a couple weeks ago about the, you know, reflagging of coal.
Two ships in the middle of the Pacific or something, right?
Right. And, you know, they are able to thwart and skirt the sanctions, sometimes with the assistance of other governments, sometimes with just pure neglect from other countries, to get some supplies that they need from the West that they technically shouldn't be able to get. So they have a pretty effective smuggling system.
Let's move on to North Korea and focus on it. So with North Korea, Kim Jong-un, of course, had given given Trump an offer to meet for a summit, face-to-face summit. Trump surprisingly accepted, and it was the first time the U.S. president will be meeting with a North Korean leader to resolve these tensions and hopefully move North Korea closer to denuclearization. We don't even have a South Korean ambassador right now, so I'm kind of curious, what kind of circus is Trump running here? How is he going to prepare for this meeting, and how is it actually going to happen?
Yeah, well, we're all asking that question. I think personally that Kim Jong-un was maybe a little bit surprised that the president accepted his offer. History would suggest that would be an easy offer for the North Korean leader to make and not have a U.S. response. So I think we haven't heard from Kim Jong-un since Trump said, yeah, let's meet.
He may say, well, maybe I don't want to do this anymore.
He might. I don't object to the notion of trying something new. I mean, we've been trying this model where we try to get negotiations, and then the meeting with the president is the carrot for the end of the process. That's not worked. Now, there's a lot of reasons it hasn't worked, not necessarily having to do with the order and the sequencing. But okay, if two leaders could meet, agree at the very top level on the endpoint of the negotiation, on the goal of the negotiation, and then say, okay, negotiators, technical experts, let's now start a process, that could work. But you got to do your homework. And now we've got, uproar at the State Department. I mean, not just no ambassador, no North Korean envoy.
Right.
Transition at the Secretary of State level, transition at the National Security Advisor level. How the bureaucracy can prepare, and I don't mean the bureaucracy in the bad way. I mean the actual experts who've been following this stuff for years, who know what's worked and not worked in the past, who understand how what the psychology is of how to talk to a leader like that, how to negotiate with a closed regime like that. Those people are, have they been given guidance to develop a negotiating strategy? Do they have access? When will they have access to the new leadership? What is the new leadership going to give in terms of ideas and guidance for how to prepare for this? Will the president be disciplined to actually read his talking points? We know he didn't at his last high-stakes conversation with a leader.
He doesn't even do it in low-stakes conversations. So when you get into the meeting, how much does trust matter here? Face to face, you say, don't worry, we'll denuclearize and I'll keep my word. Can you really trust your gut there? And
I've never known it to work in international relations. And it's certainly would not be a good basis for something as consequential as a denuclearization conversation. That's why you have verification. That's why you have,
And these happen through what organizations? They're American or international or?
Well, it depends on the setup. Yeah. In the case of the Iran deal, it was the International Atomic Energy Agency that was asked to do kind of standard safeguards, but then also a whole bunch of other inspection regimes on top of that to meet the additional commitments that Iran was asked to make. You could imagine a similar kind of request to the IAEA to come in and do that. With the U.S. and Russia, we do bilateral.
But isn't it easy to dupe these people? I mean, it's happened to the U.S. in the past with other sorts of nuclear programs around the world. Couldn't you just say, this is not a nuclear reactor. This is just a big bathtub for the Supreme Leader.
The water would be nice and warm. The IAEA has under the additional protocol, which I think would have to be the baseline understanding of any kind of IAEA-led inspection, has the ability to go to any facility and to ask, to say that we have a concern about this site. It could be a bathtub manufacturer. It could be a place that they think there's a reactor. It could be a place where there's been some instance that there's material there or whatever. They want to go check it out and confirm that there's nothing there, or if there is something there, to address it. So the additional protocol gives the IAEA the ability to go wherever they want. And note, there has been no country that has ever developed a covert nuclear weapons operation that has been under the additional protocol level of inspection.
When we ask North Korea to denuclearize, is it really possible to forget something that they've already known? I mean, I tried the other day I tried to forget how to ride a bike, but I still am really good at riding a bicycle no matter how hard I try. How can you expect a country to forget how to do that sort of stuff?
Well, you can't control what's been developed in the brain. What you can control is what they do with it. You can make sure that the material that is created is the character of material that it's intended to be for any kind of a peaceful use, that the material is consistent with that peaceful use, that the X amount of material is there and it's the same amount next week or the next month or the next year when people come back to look at it, that it's only in the places it's supposed to be and that it's not in places it's not supposed to be. So you have to you have to manage the facilities and the material and the real world stuff that exists. But you're never gonna, we don't have neuralizers yet, so you're never gonna be able to erase a brain.
Well, Laura, if you don't mind, I would like to move on to the snack portion, have some of these chocolates that we've got. Eric, if you wouldn't mind.
Certainly don't mind.
You know, we have a special, these are salted caramels, which I know, and these are from a local place called L.A. Burdick.
Look at that.
Started in New Hampshire, and now they've been around for about 30 years. These are, I was told, there's one on the top and one on the bottom, and one of them is vanilla, and the other one is cardamom. They're all chocolate-covered caramels, so I don't know if you have a preference between those two. Frankly, I forgot which one's which, but we'll just have to try both, I think, and see what happens.
Yes, I think we'll just try it out. Oh, that's good.
I think that's the cardamom.
Actually tell. I'm getting such strong chocolate and salt, I'm having trouble distinguishing the flavor of the caramel.
I think that's, we'll have to try the other one. So, one of the things about vanilla that always confused me is, you know, people say, you know, oh, he or she is so vanilla. It's a pejorative term. But vanilla is an expensive, exotic spice. And I've always thought that actually, if you call somebody vanilla, it probably should mean that you're complimenting them, that they're exotic or maybe it's expensive, but or that they're they're really cool. I don't know if you've ever had that thought, but I have.
No, I haven't, but it's a worthy thought. On the other hand, if you're standing in front of the gelato guy, and you've got the vanilla, it looks plain. It may not be plain, but then you've got mango, and you've got raspberry, and then you've got triple duple chocolate. The vanilla one might look kind of boring.
I used to work at a chocolate shop back in Kansas City, where we're both from.
Yeah.
Called
Which one?
Andre's Confiserie. Have you been? You're a big fan? They make the best chocolate in the world.
Yeah.
And you're from Kansas City originally. One of things I've wondered was, when you left Kansas City, and you haven't lived in Kansas City in some time, the people talk about this brain drain. And do you ever feel like there's a pull for you to go back, or in your career, was there ever a moment where you thought, there's this some sort of tug at me to go back to Kansas City?
Well, the only tug in me to go back to Kansas City is Hayward's Pit Barbecue. Having set my sights very early on a career in the international environment, there's certainly when I left Kansas City in the early 80s, there wasn't a lot of that going on. I bet there is more international business going on there now than before, but not a lot of arms control, non-proliferation, weapons of mass destruction stuff. Although the Kansas City plant, the DOE's Kansas City plant is based there, where they make all the non-nuclear components.
Did your profession ever take you there?
Of our nuclear weapons? Sadly, no, because I've always worked on the nuclear side of things.
Okay. But
I've been watching it from a distance. And it came in, it was one of the few Department of Energy facilities that came in on time and under budget, so it got a lot of love from a DOE procurement team that's pretty demoralized.
Well, Laura, thank you so much for joining today. It's been a pleasure to have you on and talking about North Korea and loose nukes and all these kind of horrible and crazy things, but thank you for your time.
Well, the chocolate makes it all the more sweeter. Thank you very much.
This episode of Snack Break was produced with the help of the Media Production Center, Hauser Studio, Tara Cavanaugh, and Harris Passeltiner. Introduction music was composed by Evan Fennessy. To learn more about the show, or watch episodes rather than listen to them, find us on YouTube or visit our website at snackbreakshow.com.